Well, it's either that or he bought a used sex doll that still had semen on it.
Yeah, yep.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Daddy, what's coming out of the toy?
I don't know.
God, Michael, it looks like semen.
I don't know. I just got it at a store. I don't know.
What's semen, Mommy?
Oh, it's just a liquid, Henry. It's just a liquid.
Hello, everybody. It's episode 164 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hidely-ho, steamed mirrorinos.
Yeah. And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
I like puppet sex.
Don't we all? Mm-hmm. Don't we all? It's a whole genre unto itself.
So. Oh, genre of movies. I'm sorry. I thought you were proclaiming some sort of individual personal lifestyle choices. But
why not both? Too? You can't be into the movies without having the lifestyle too. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you coming out. Let's start off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Aaron.
Yeah, it's Eurovision time, so I'm going to recommend it. Maybe again, I don't know. Maybe I've talked about this before. I have to preach the gospel of this contest, which has been going on since the 60s, the 1960s. And it's just this thing Americans don't really know, or if they do know, they don't care about. And it blows my mind because I have so much fun with it every year. This is a song contest that Europe does. They also include Australia, and I think there are a couple other non-European countries that maybe sneak in. There are 36 countries that compete. They each have this thorough process of picking the song and who's going to sing it and what it's going to be. And then they stage this 3-hour live show that is some of the best produced stagecraft I have ever seen in my life. Some of the stagecraft that's going on, it's kind of the primary reason I love watching Eurovision, is just to go, how did that? Like, this time they had drones in the stadium doing cool things, and they had this big, like, giant TV frame that was like front of, like, ahead of stage through a walkway that they could also put things on. It's just like creative and innovative. And the songs, while not necessarily good sometimes, are always interesting. And sometimes it's the quirky, interesting songs that will break through and do really well. I'll tell you how this operates in a second, because that's another fun part of it. But it's fun to watch specifically the final. If you're really into it, you can watch the semifinals. There are two semifinal nights where they whittle down to 24 acts, and then all of them perform at the final, and then they go to the voting stage. Now, the voting stage is interesting because every country that participates has a jury that awards votes. So they can award 12 points for first place, 10 points for second place, 8 points for third place, and then 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So they will award that many countries a certain amount of points. So they will go through country by country. They will cut to them live in their country and say, what are your votes? They'll put their votes up on the screen, and they'll say, for 12 points, we vote for such and such a country. And then they'll celebrate, yay. And then you'll see these like standing shift based on what these countries are doing. But that's only 50% of it, because the populace is voting as well. So it'll get to the end of this, and then they'll go with the bottom point total, and they'll say how many points like the voting populace gave them, and things will start to jumble until they get right to the end. So it's always like, who's going to win, you know, like right at the end. And so it's kind of fun in that way too. And then there are the fun moments where it's like, UK, which never does well because every other country hates the UK, you know, which is how America would do in this show, by the way, if we submitted a song. Yep. Every other country hates the UK. So the UK from all the country juries ended up, I think, in like 13th or 14th place and had, you know, let's just say 65 votes. So they're going through these countries, and you can get up to 450 votes from the populace. Usually countries are getting 12 votes, 40 votes, 120 votes, you know, that kind of thing. They get to the UK, from the voting public, the UK receives zero votes. Zero points, I should say. And a lot of that is also because you can't vote for your own country. So wherever you're calling from, you can't. If you're calling from the UK, you can't vote from the UK, that kind of thing. Mm. Anyways, I just have so much fun with this. This was this last Saturday when it happened. It is still available on Peacock. If you want to just go peep it and kind of see, man, is this something I might enjoy watching live, you know, some year? It's quite a show. It's quite a fun show. And I like letting people know about it because, like I said, in America, it just kind of doesn't exist.
Yeah. It may or may not appeal to me. I'm not sure, but I did like the movie that came out a few years ago.
Yes.
The Will Ferrell, Rachel McAdams, Dan Stevens movie. I was, was a big fan of that when it came out. But yeah, I don't know. I think I would. I think I might enjoy this. I'm not sure. I may give it.
Yeah, throw it on from Peacock and just kind of see if it's something you might like.
Yeah. Jeremy, what do you got?
I got an Instagram account that I have been enjoying following. It's a food chef influencer lady named Olivia Tiedemann, and her Instagram is Olivia Tied. This is the fastest rise to popularity that I have ever seen. Less than 2 years ago, she was a private chef in the Hamptons, and she just started posting videos. They're like a lot of food influencer videos in that they're cut pretty rapid. So what she spends 45 minutes doing, you see in the span of about a minute and 30 seconds. She's got great taste in music. She always plays like a rock song underneath it, and she always flips you off in the middle of the video somewhere. and I noticed her because I was on Reddit, on the food subreddit, and she started getting posted there by people almost every video, and half of that subreddit hated her. And half of that subreddit loved her. That's basically how the internet works. And now she's got 4.5 million subscribers. She's made content with Jimmy Fallon, Tom Colicchio, Giada De Laurentiis, Maddie Matheson. And her food looks great. I haven't had a chance to eat it, but looks really good. And so, yeah, I really enjoy her content. She posts a couple times a week. And does a lot of collaborations with other food influencer people, and I just wanted to put that on your map.
All right. Okay. I mean, man, I imagine all of these particular posts probably make you hungry in some way, right? They're just like they're like chef all over again from last week. I will have to give it a look. I am not on Instagram. I'm old. I don't know. I don't know anything about that at all. I look every once in a while, I get sent some Instagram stuff that I watch. So.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about Instagram a year and a half, 2 years ago, and now it's my very favorite. Despite being owned by Facebook, it's my favorite social place to go because the algorithm just feeds you more of what you watch, and I watch puppy videos and food videos and cat videos. And so that Instagram is my happy place now. If I need a pick me up, I just go over there and scroll for a half an hour and I'm smiling.
Simmons is old.
Yes.
I think I exist how you do on Instagram on Reddit, actually, Jeremy. I think Reddit can be very catered because you can join certain communities.
It's very similar.
So, yeah, it's where I've kind of found my social place. I've never seen Olivia other than kind of doing research when she said you were going to talk about her. And it strikes me as the kind of person who you're just happy to see doing well. You know, like they seem to have a really fun, interesting personality, and it's just like, good. I'm glad they're getting some eyeballs on them. So, yeah, good stuff.
Yep.
My small recommend comes from Apple TV. It is called The Studio. It is almost over. I think there's like 3 more episodes left. I've watched 9 of the 9. I think there's 9 episodes out right now.
Mm-hmm.
3 more left, I believe. It follows Seth Rogen, as you can see in the picture there, is a guy who takes over a studio, is given the job to be the head of the studio, and he's got these great dreams that, you know, he's going to make it like this art house type of thing, like back in the 70s again type of thing. But his CEO boss, played by Bryan Cranston, who occasionally shows up in episodes, tells him that one of the first movies he has to make is based on The Kool-Aid Man. And so he has to make a Kool-Aid movie. And and so the first episode is him trying to balance all this this ideal that he had with, you know, I'm going to make these art house movies and then somehow also make a Kool-Aid man. And so the first episode has him you know, trying to figure out the machinations of making a Kool-Aid movie, but also trying to woo Martin Scorsese on his next movie. And Martin Scorsese just so happens to be making a movie about Jonestown, which drink the Kool-Aid
God.
Comes from that. So he has to fight this battle of like he gets Scorsese on board he gives him a whole bunch of money, but asks for one stipulation: could you call this movie Kool-Aid the movie? And
this show is so good.
It's so good, man. It's so very good. There's so many episodes.
Is everything that the franchise show was supposed to be. I've heard nothing but great things about this show. I'm so excited that you're loving it.
But there are my favorite episodes, and it's shot really well too. There's a lot of like one takes that I'm sure they do a lot of hidden cuts with, but it's a very like oh, this is all happening in real time kind of show on almost every episode. But my favorite one might be when they are trying to cast the Kool-Aid movie, and if I tell you that part, then that might ruin what I just told you about the first part, so I won't get that far. But there are each episode has these great like real Hollywood issues that they're having to deal with, and all this is why it's so hard to make good movies. And they have to deal with the business side of it. They got to deal with the creatives, and they've got to deal with their own like idea of what, if they're doing the right thing. And there's one that's really the one that where Ron Howard makes a guest appearance, where he makes a movie. And they are watching, a rough cut of it, and they are loving it. It's 2 hours, a perfect movie, and then all of a sudden it goes on a 45-minute tangent that is slow and boring and doesn't belong there. But no one has the balls to tell Ron Howard that it shouldn't be there. And so there's this whole like trying to pass off like, Should we tell Ron Howard about this being boring? And then like, then you find out there's even more to it. The reason why that 45 minutes is in there that makes it even harder for people to tell him to cut it out. It's a really, really fun show. I highly recommend it. Like I said, after I've seen 9 episodes, I'm ready to recommend this wholeheartedly. Actually, after the first 2 or 3 episodes, I was ready to do it, but I wanted to get close to the full season and before I said anything about it. So
yeah,
really, really good.
It's so good. And I did just look at it. I think it's just a 10 episode season. So I think the finale is next week.
I thought it said 12. Okay. And so there's a finale next week. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And now's the perfect time to just hop on and binge what you want and just laugh and laugh and laugh. Every episode has this hook that is so clever and so interesting. You mentioned the Ron Howard one about telling a director to cut something personal to them. One of my favorites is when they're trying to figure out how to be sensitive to casting the Kool-Aid movie. Yep. And where that goes in the end punchline on that is so smart and interesting and thought-provoking and funny. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
like it's, I'm kind of blown away by this. I love it. And every time a new one pops up, I can't get to it fast enough. It's just so fun.
Oh yeah. Yeah. One of the fastest, I mean, it's only like a 30-minute show anyway, mm-hmm. but it's one of the fastest moving 30 minutes that you'll see.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, and this is Aaron's. So, Aaron, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Okay, Anomalisa is a 2015 movie written and directed by Charlie Kaufman and co-directed, by the way, by Duke Johnson as well. Mm-hmm. It is Kaufman's first and only animated feature film, was financed through Kickstarter, and was the only rated R film in history to be nominated for the animated feature Oscar until last year's Memoir of a Snail. It unfortunately had to go up against Inside Out that year, though, which ironically would have been an amazing title for this movie as well. We begin in a black void of constant inane conversations before we see clouds and an airplane. It's not the airplane our protagonist is on, but it is the airplane the protagonist can see from the airplane he is on. His name is Michael, and he takes some pills and pulls out a letter for some light reading. The letter is visually narrated by a woman with a man's voice and a generic face who swears at him for walking away after all the things he said and also all the sex they had. The plane lands, and the crew member with the same voice and face as the breakup woman welcomes them to Cincinnati. His seatmate is apparently holding his hand and also has the same voice. And yep, that's going to be a thing. Every voice he hears sounds just like that Tooth Fairy serial killer guy from Manhunter and has the same dull, stupid face, except for his own voice, which sounds like the god Ares from Wonder Woman. Anyhow, he makes his way through the airport and catches a taxi to his hotel. By the way, taxis were the place where you had unwelcome conversations before rideshares existed. After the taxi driver fails to get the hint that he's not interested and misinterprets what kind of toy store he's looking for, he finally arrives at the Fregoli Hotel. In a continued stop-motion oneer, he checks in, has small talk with the busboy in an eternal hallway, and gives him a tip before ending the long uncut shot by urinating in the toilet. He heads into the evening by ordering some room service through a confusing set of phone buttons. He then makes a perfunctory phone call home to his also serial killer-voiced wife and child. Before getting some practice on his customer service speech for tomorrow, he decides to play a little Rear Window on a guy who's just trying to have some personal time with his computer. After pouring himself a drink and starting to practice his speech again, he's interrupted by a vision of the same woman from the letter earlier. He then looks up the name Bella Amorosi in the phone book. By the way, phone books were the things you used to find a way to connect with old flings while in town for business and not hoping for an affair at all, just wanted to connect. But also, do you want to get a drink together? And also, I don't care about your weight gain or fake tooth, but I'm totally not hoping for an affair, just some drinks. Did I mention that before social media existed? They do indeed meet for drinks and rehash the pain of how he hurt her straight into him asking if she wants to have a drink in his room, which goes just about as well as you would expect. He then finds his way into the wrong kind of toy store, for that matter. That would be an interesting version of Toy Story, for sure. Mm-hmm. Where he is mesmerized by an antique Japanese sex doll. Back at the hotel, he emerges from a battle of water temperature in the shower to see some strange things happening to the lower part of his face. But just at the moment he seems about to discover something, he hears a voice that isn't the Tooth Fairy killer. Frantically, he flops his stop-motion genitalia around to get some pants on before knocking on several doors, just hoping to find this person. He then finds eventually a couple of fans of his book in a random room, and one of them is the different voice girl. Her name is Lisa, and she's the stereotypical single white female. But he thinks she has the voice of an angel. He seems aware that her voice is different and immediately fascinated by her. He takes her and her friend Emily down to the bar, and it becomes quickly obvious that he's interested in everything Lisa is saying, even when she gets button possessive in the elevator on the way back up. Emily is all into him, but he finds a way to ask Lisa instead for some drunk sexy time and also not offend Emily too much, though I'm not sure that that is the primary ethical navigation we should be worried about at this point. Mm-hmm. Lisa opens up about her insecurities and is brave enough to sing a bit of Cyndi Lauper, and it moves Michael to tears.
A bit?
Sorry, I'll rephrase. Lisa opens up about her insecurities and is brave enough to sing all of the Cyndi Lauper, and it moves Michael to tears. And then they kiss. And then Lisa tells him she feels like an anomaly, and the titular portmanteau is born. And speaking of titulars, I guess when Lisa admitted earlier that she didn't know what turn down service is, she wasn't lying, because she does not turn down any of the services Michael offers her after that in the most explicit stop motion sex this side of Team America World Police. The next morning, someone from the hotel rings with a matter of some delicacy to chat about. So Michael finds his way down to the cavernous office of Mr. Gill, whose office is so big he needs a golf cart for guests to get to him. Are the metaphors in this movie getting more and more literal? After driving the golf cart to Mr. Gill's desk, Gill tells him that he's in love with him and would rather he be having an affair with him and not Lisa. In fact, anybody else, just anyone else could have an affair with him, just not Lisa. This understandably freaks Michael out, so he runs back to get Lisa to safety from those freaks, but not before having the bottom half of his face fall off. That's right. You heard me. His face fell off. Deal with it. Also, it's actually all a nightmare. Or is it?
Mm.
Yes, it is. Anyways, the next morning, over some scrambled eggs, Michael tells Lisa he wants to divorce his wife and be with her. She says it's all very sudden, but agrees before he immediately complains about the way she eats, gaslights her about being controlling, and snaps at her for speaking with her mouth full. But when she starts talking about going to the zoo, just moments later, her voice starts morphing into the same voice as everyone else until all he hears as he says he will see her after the speech, but we know he won't. Let's just say the speech doesn't go very well. He's talking about customer service and treating people like individuals, but it's clear he's having a breakdown inside his solitary, lonely, and purposeless head. You can hear a smile. Smiles are free. And also, the president is a war criminal. Great speech, honestly. He manages to eventually gather his thoughts, but they're all hollow and meaningless now. He hops on a plane and he heads home. After giving his kid his Japanese sex torso gift, he is surprised by a party of surprise party attendees. He gets upset with his wife for doing that. She reacts, and he is left to sit on his stairs to ponder the unique voice of his child's new adult toy and to realize he himself is more false, broken, and unable to be authentically real than even that toy is. We end as Anomalisa takes back her own voice and finds growth as she heads into a better future with a now uniquely faced Emily beside her, away from this empty man, unable to find reality outside his own narcissistic emptiness. And that is Anomalisa. And I am so curious what you guys thought about this movie this time through.
Jeremy, kick us off.
Oh, God.
Yep.
I think I gave this as open-minded a viewing as possible.
Okay.
The end. The
Chris. End. All right, let me talk about it.
So I didn't love it. I think I see what it's trying to do. I think I understand most of its surface themes. It felt to me more like an exercise in awesome puppetry than it did anything that connected to me emotionally. My biggest all caps note was how badass the ice machine animation is when he goes to get ice in the hotel ice machine. And there are times like the Cyndi Lauper song or when he gets out of the shower that it just feels like the moment goes on forever. And when you remember this was a 40-minute short originally, it starts to feel to me like padding. But there's artistry here. Again, the stop motion work is incredible. It's a completely different visual stop motion style from that Pinocchio movie that Del Toro did, but it impressed me on the same level. In terms of what they were able to accomplish. Like even that wonder that you're talking about at the hotel, like there's just a lot of impressive puppetry and stop motion work. And that's what I was left with more than anything in the story. And I don't know why I would never be inspired as a creative person to tell a story about a person like this. But I recognize that Charlie Kaufman and I are not the same person and everybody is inspired by different things. And you know what? This movie has a really good score on Rotten Tomatoes. People love it. Well, just because I didn't love it, that doesn't mean you won't love it. But no, I did not really connect to the film. And I apologize that I can't give more cheerleading. But I have now seen three movies where puppets have sex. And I just think that's worth noting. And if I get to four or five, I'm retiring.
All right. All right. I love this movie. And it was disappointing. I'm not saying you guys are wrong. It was disappointing to see how many people, not only in our chat right now, but on Discord, who were not digging this movie either. And I was surprised by that because I feel like this is a really good movie, and it's, I don't know what's actually wrong with it, like connecting with a lot of people. I thought more people felt like Michael Stone than I thought that there were more people out there that would relate to somebody like this. I certainly relate to somebody like this. Not the fact that everybody sounds the same or anything like that. It's more about the fact that, you know, there's just sometimes all these people that there's just nobody out there that impresses you, and you're very depressed about that. And it just, it sucks because he's like, it sounds like he's, and even though he's married and he has a kid, he's very alone. And that's basically what it comes down to. And, you know, you live that lonely life of traveling city to city, and you've got this boring job. I don't know why he's so famous, unless it's just at the hotel. Everybody knows him there because they're about to go to this conference.
I think that's what it is. Yeah, they're about to see his speech. That's the only thing.
Okay, because
yeah.
it felt like he was world famous when he was walking through the hotel, and I felt like that was something the movie wasn't quite getting us on, like explaining well. But I figured in the end it was just because so many people knew who he was from the conference. But I really love that idea of everybody having the sameness to them, and someone who just can't, he can't figure out, why everybody, he's got a condition of some sort here. And even Lisa herself is not special. That's the thing that's so crazy about it. There is nothing special about her. There's some sort of like something that has broken through. And I think that comes with a lot of relationships where you suddenly fall in love with somebody and nobody else can see it, but you can see why. And it's like, how do you explain to somebody, how do you explain to the person you're with that they're special, even though there's nothing about them whatsoever that's really all that special in the end? And that's, I thought that came off very real to me, to have that kind of, relationship to the world. I was a little disappointed that dream sequence was a dream. I was hoping that would be kind of like real.
Yeah, I remember the first time I watched it feeling the same way, just like, I was really hoping we were going to go some weird places. And it's just
and with Charlie Kaufman sitting there, I mean, that is the most Charlie Kaufman part of the entire movie, is that dream and having to take a golf cart to the desk and having this for no reason hole in the middle of the office that you can fall into.
The sunken meeting place.
The sunken meeting place.
That was a thing for a while. Do you remember that in houses they would build those, anyways, like couches around a sunken
square? They would build couch pits, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so weird.
Yeah. So I don't know. This kind of character appeals to me on a level, and all the little mundane things at the beginning are funny as hell to me. This is something that I struggle with. You get into a taxi cab and that, or an Uber or whatever, and that person is real chatty, and like, how do you keep up this enthusiasm, you know, to talk to this person, and you know, the person is just saying all this nonsense, basically like, oh, you should go to the zoo, oh yeah, the zoo is great, you know, like you'd be able to do it in a day, it's zoo sized. And then you see later on the advertisement for the zoo says it's zoo sized. I thought that was hilarious. There's that conversation happening out in the hallway where the guy and the girl are just like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And it's exactly the type of, you've heard these conversations before, and they're just like, where does this end? You just keep on saying fuck you to each other and everything. It makes me laugh every time. And this is exactly the type of, I don't know how many people out there have watched this movie, have been to Cincinnati, but this is the type of thing, by the way, that you hear all the time. You hear about the zoo and you hear about the chili. You hear about the chili all the time. Oh, they put chocolate in the chili. It's amazing and blah, blah, blah. I've never had Cincinnati chili, but that's apparently what's so good about the freaking chili in Cincinnati is that they put that, and they have the, what's the 24 hour place or whatever that everybody loves going to? I can't
Skyline?
Remember. Skyline? Huh?
This is Skyline?
Skyline. Yeah.
Skyline. That's it.
So when I went to Louisville for training when I was going to work for Kroger, everyone there told me not to eat at Skyline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I've heard too.
So I think Skyline might be one of the things that people outside Cincinnati or that area, they come in and they're like, oh, we got to try that Cincinnati chili over spaghetti. But the locals are all like, no, that shit'll wreck you.
I've been to Cincinnati a couple of times. I've never had the chili. I've never been to Skyline. So, but I think this is such a. I feel like Charlie Kaufman has definitely been there and has really done his homework on what it's like to go there. And I like even the detail that they go to the Cincinnati / Northern Kentucky Airport, which is exactly where it's exactly what it's called. Anyway, I love all of this. I went and rewatched all the behind the scenes features that are on the Blu-ray. And there's a 30-minute making of on this that you think you know how much work went into this until you hear them actually talk about it. Now, I understand the work that they put into the animation and everything doesn't necessarily make a good movie for a lot of people. But once you do love the movie, seeing all the different details and everything is astonishing. Like all the different, we see the face fall off during the dream sequence. Like that's how they got the expressions of all these things. They build like 100-something different expressions for each of these puppets. The two puppets were modeled after real people. And then all the sets and stuff, I'm sitting there thinking that because they built apparently 15 sets. It ended up being 21 or something like that. When it got done, the one of the biggest challenges they had was they were filming during the summer, I believe. So they would, it takes forever to do stop motion. You have to set everything up perfectly and then you have to adjust something slightly and you have to make sure that it's all the, whatever it is that you're moving, that's definitely moving and everything else is definitely stopped and the camera has to be in the same spot and all that. So they were hoping the animators would come out with 48 frames a day, but that wasn't, and 48 frames is 2 seconds, by the way. They were hoping that the animators would get that, but they'd only got that most of the time they would get like 8 to 12 or something like that. It takes forever to do all this stuff. What would happen is they would be filming in the middle of summer. It was super hot and everything. They have all these lights too that they're using to get everything lit correctly. And then like they would get done with a couple of frames and then they'd leave for the evening. Then everything would cool down. So the sets, the hot wood would like expand and then it would contract during the middle of the night. They'd come back, turn on the camera. Everything was off. And they'd have to do all this stuff like jack up the table or something like that they were using, or they had to do something else. They did it. There's a 9-minute feature on the sex scene alone in this.
Wow.
Where they wanted to make it where it was realistic as possible. So they had to put wire somewhere to get all the clothes off and all that. And someone had the idea to put wires in Michael's shirt and when it was peeled off, it would peel off a certain way. And then they had to replace that shirt with another shirt where the wires were facing the other way to make it look real.
Wow.
So like there was a million things that went into this. I know that the overall product for some people, it's not going to be a great movie for them. When you factor in the work and stuff, that's the stuff that I think even if you don't like this movie, you should try to find a making of for this. I think you will find an appreciation for that at least, if not the movie. So that's what I got to say about this. I think I love the performances in this. David Thewlis has a very unique voice that I enjoy. Kind of ironically, I guess, for this movie. And I love Jennifer Jason Leigh in here. And of course, Tom Noonan is, even though it's just the same voice over and over and over again, he finds a way, I think, in each character to find, you know, to find a little bit of creativity in each one of those, even though he's just kind of doing the same voice on every one of them. So in the end, yeah, I'm a big fan of this movie.
I'm glad we had some commentary from both sides. I don't think it needs stated, but I'll state it anyway. Of course, Jeremy, you should never feel bad about not liking a movie. Like, there's no need to apologize for, you know, having your own experience with, you know, whatever's put in front of you.
Well,
I'm certainly more on the Chris side. I love this movie. I mean, considering I was the one that recommended, that's probably not a surprise. Watching it again, I love it even more. I was able to really sink into some of the things this movie is saying in ways it's saying them that I hadn't noticed before, and I'll try to bring out a couple of those. But just overall, this movie feels to me to speak to something that I don't see in a lot of movies. I see it in some that I think is, I don't know how modern it is or if it's always been around, but this idea of main character syndrome is a term I've heard for it, where you live your life in a way that you, every narrative you build has to put you as the main character because you are you. So you live your life as the main character. And how difficult it is for, I would say, most of us to really break out of that, to really understand that everybody is a main character, right? Like, you know, that, and I would call it like the NPC-ification of life, right? Where everybody you see is just an NPC. It doesn't, you know, impact you unless there's something you specifically can gain from it or something that you specifically find interesting. And the way this movie speaks to that with the inane conversations, talking about the weather, talking about the same thing everybody in Cincinnati talks about, if it was a different city, it would be the same thing that everybody, you know, if you're coming to Springfield, everybody's telling you about Lambert's, the home of throat rolls. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this idea that there are all these things that exist around us that are not conducive to us understanding the reality of life in all of these individual human beings. Now, this comes into really interesting relief in his speech, where he is specifically saying to treat the customer as an individual, mm-hmm. treat them as this specific thing. And the name of his book is so interesting to me. May I help you help them? And mm-hmm. it's just this second degree of removal from actually having to understand what it means to look at somebody in a genuine or real way. And this is not something that I feel like Michael is doing purposefully. I think it's something he's experiencing. It's also not something he's happy with, obviously. It's obviously destroying him. Like, the fact that he can't find authenticity or reality in other people, in other situations, is really hurting him. And because we see that, I feel like the movie has a lot of empathy, maybe pity is the right word more than empathy, but a real understanding of it's, yes, he is a quote-unquote bad person because some of the, you know, the bad ways he speaks to people or sees people or those kind of things, but he is also in his own way trying to figure out where in his pursuit of Lisa is part of that, like, okay, why is this different? What am I finding here? And man, I just think the movie gives him a lot of that, the honor of his humanity, even as it paints him as a broken, hopeless person. And I don't know. There's something really interesting with what the movie is doing with all that stuff.
Did you say the name of the hotel was the Fregoli Hotel?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And that is very meaningful.
Because
yes.
That is, Francis Fregoli is the guy who basically came up with the name for the Fregoli delusion, which is supposedly what this guy has, where mm-hmm. you think everyone else in the world is one person and they change appearance or they're in disguise.
Right.
And I think that's fascinating to see that level of detail And yeah, I have respect for this movie, even if I didn't enjoy it the way you sure. guys did.
Well, and I think it's important for me to say, I think the Fregoli idea is not to say Michael literally has Fregoli syndrome. It's to use Fregoli syndrome as a metaphor for what more people are feeling in their life, if that makes sense. So like the Fregoli syndrome is the metaphor, him seeing everybody as the same, for what it feels like to go through life, you know, in this way, and to, you know, to have so much trouble seeing people's value or importance outside of your own narrative. That again, that's my interpretation, but I don't think it's supposed to mean literally he has this syndrome. I think it's supposed to be a representation of something that he's going through. In the same way, there's been some, you know, theories that Lisa isn't real, that Lisa is the Japanese sex doll. And that he buys the sex doll, and then all the stuff with Lisa is,
well, it's,
you know,
either that or he bought a used sex doll that still had semen on it. Right?
Yes.
There's
yes.
a reason the wife points out his wife looks like semen. The kid's like, "What's semen, mommy?"
That's the that's what just you call the guy. It's what the guy you call the guys on the boat. So he, I tend to look at that as, again, a metaphor. Like this sex doll is a representation of how he treated Lisa, right? Like that is, so yes, they are the same, but I don't think literally the same. I think metaphorically the same, story-wise. I don't think it's a big theory thing for me as much as it is an example of, at the end, him staring at that sex doll going, oh, you know, this is how I treat people, or this is, you know, just as interesting. Because notice the sex doll also has a unique voice. So like there is, you know, there's definitely something going on there where like, you know, do you use people, see them as, you know, this thing that exists for your story, or do you understand their own stories? And I do think very specifically, the movie ends the way it does to drive home that metaphor, specifically with Lisa's friend Emily now having a unique face in that last scene. If, you know, she has escaped this kind of
whose POV are we in there though? Lisa's?
The cameras. I think we're literally seeing her drive. I don't think it's in anybody's POV. I think it's just
Felt weird to have followed him the whole movie, and then the last scene is those two girls, and one of them has a new face.
I mean, if you're of the idea that Lisa was a figment of his imagination the entire time, then it's from his perspective. He's thinking about her driving along the road and, and writing this note or thinking these things.
The note is
or
pretty
whatever.
Kind, right? Like, it's a pretty nice note. I hope we'll meet again and maybe reconnect.
Yeah, I don't read it that way, but yeah.
I know. It could go either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And from the chat, we also, I guess Jennifer Jason Leigh also voiced the sex doll as well. So
yes,
I guess there's,
put that on your resume. All
right. Exactly. So I guess if you're in that theory, then, you know, then you can continue that along there. Like, she never was real. And he was hoping so hard to find somebody real that it ended up being just the sex doll the whole time.
I can tell you how I read it personally, which was as a way for the author to say of this story to say, I understand people are different, right? Like I understand that this person isn't necessarily everybody. And that, you know, some people can find a way to actually have authentic life outside of this. Just as a little hopeful note at the end, somebody in the comments mentioned it might have been a studio note to have a little bit of hope at the end. I don't know.
I don't think there was any studio notes on this movie.
Yeah, it was a Kickstarter.
It was a Kickstarter, and it was also the Starburns Incorporated, which is a part of what's his name, Dino Stamatopoulos, or one of his brother. His brother's name, I can't remember. It's Stamatopoulos is his name. They created a whole company with Dan Harmon to make this movie. And then I think they sold it to Paramount afterwards. So I don't think Paramount was sitting there going, we need to have this and that. This movie almost didn't get made. They were almost ran out of money during the making of it. So I don't know if it was a studio note. It would have been a bizarre studio note from them. I think pretty much Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson were calling the shots.
Yeah, I think so too. The only other thing, one thing I wanted to mention was the song over the end credits where Tom Noonan sings this None of Them Are You song is, for me, worth sticking around for. I just, that song is so interesting, and the way he sings it is so atypical, you know, as to one of those songs. It just, it makes it really interesting and fun.
He said something in one of those that he was upset that he wasn't going to be able to do different voices, because in the earlier version, which was just them on stage, basically doing a radio version of this this thing. So it was like 2 days in LA. They did a radio or an audio version of this. And everybody knows that when Tom Noonan is doing a voice there, that I think he was allowed to kind of do a little bit more with it. And then when it gets to the movie, he has like, oh, we want you to be the same. And he was like, I was worried that maybe, you know, that people didn't think I could do voices or something if I did it that way. Yeah. But I went ahead and did it, and I think it was good for the movie or whatever. So,
yep.
All right, let's get on to the super secret double feature.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
And I will kick us off. I've got two movies in mind. I will only say one, and I'll say the other after Jeremy is done with his. But the fact of a person looking for something special and not finding it throughout the movie, and is finding flaws with other people throughout so that they can find a way to be shitty to other people and everything, reminded me a lot of High Fidelity. The John Cusack movie where he is at a record store and he has just broken up with his girlfriend, and he has to think about all the other relationships he's been in where something inevitably failed about it, and he wants to know whether was it you or me, or did we both do something or whatever. And he basically goes back to interview all of his former girlfriends to figure out whether or not, you know, did he screw something up or whatever. But I love the end of High Fidelity, where he sort of realizes that he has been doing this. He's been looking for something special every single time. And once the newness gets away, he loses interest. And I felt a lot of that character in Michael Stone on this one. So High Fidelity is my super secret double feature.
Very good. Did not see that coming. I almost went with A Serious Man, because like this movie, some stuff happens, but I decided there was enough with masks and identity and relationships and is what's happening around me real or not, and I'm going with Vanilla Sky. I think there are a lot of similar themes at play here. I just think that would be an interesting pairing to watch two people look at the world around them and not necessarily be able to know what's real and what's not. Who's against them? Who's conspiring against them? Who's on their side? So there you go, Vanilla Sky.
The other one that I had in the chamber there was Lost in Translation.
I had that one too.
Yeah, I like it as far as the sort of the mood of the movie is concerned, but But I mean, and Bill Murray is very much Michael Stone in many ways in that movie, and just the overall vibe of that picture, I think goes well with this one. So that was the other one I had in mind.
I want to throw one in just because I was watching the movie this time, I was like, oh, this is a really interesting comparison and might make a good double feature, is Alex Garland's Men. It's kind of
you'd be forcing people to watch Alex Garland's Men.
Yeah,
I'm a bit of an apologist for that movie, but it is kind of the similar thing from the opposite perspective, right? Like, there's, you know, it's from the Lisa perspective. What are the things we deal with when we think of how, you know, in gender roles, how a woman sees all men as the same.
I'm laughing at the comment that says another movie
too.
That sucks.
Nolan says another movie that sucks. Good choice, Aaron.
I am who I am.
By the way, one day, I need you to explain to me what you do love about Men.
I
can see things about it that I like, but in the end, I just didn't land on that being a good positive experience, and I couldn't figure out if I could ever get a positive experience out.
I think it's what I'll just say this very simply, and so we don't have to go in full discussion, but you and I can have a conversation at any point. But I think I like it in the same way I like a movie like Mother! Which is, I'm not engaging with it on any kind of literal level. I'm really engaging with it on a thought-provoking, metaphorical level almost solely. The love comes from the things I think, that I'm grappling with as I watch it in what's trying to be said. That's probably the simple way to kind of explain, you know, my thought process in a movie like that. So that scene's great. I don't care if you like the movie or not. That echo scene is amazing.
I agree. I love that scene too. I think I like the first 30 minutes of Men more than I like.
Yeah.
Anything and then everything after that, no.
Yeah.
All right. Next week's homework. It is my turn to choose again. And I am going to pick a movie that I have not seen in quite some time. But I think this goes along well with, since we did Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a 1967 movie with Sidney Poitier and Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. Let's do the other Sidney Poitier movie from 1967, which is In the Heat of the Night. This is a really good mystery story with, of course, it's set in Mississippi, racism is a huge, huge deal in this movie. A case where a black man is accused of a crime, and we have Sidney Poitier coming down as Detective Tibbs from Philadelphia to help out with the case. And so I am very excited to watch this one again. It's been over 10 years since I've seen it, and I really want to revisit it. And that will be the homework for next week. So
it's on all kinds of free places. It looks to me like it's on Tubi, Pluto, Roku, and Amazon Prime for free. So lots of options there.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is great. How have I seen this more recently than you have? I don't think I even watched this movie until you recommended it to me.
I don't know. It's been a long time. It's just one of those movies that I'm like, I need to watch that again. And then I don't for whatever reason. And now I'm going to force myself to, because it's time to get a revisit in on it. So, it looks like we have time for a question or two. So let's go on to that.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
What's a movie you would love to see as a stage show / musical?
I said Requiem for a Dream. Just kidding.
Yes.
And then my real answer is Gremlins. I think we could get out of a Gremlins musical something along the lines of Little Shop of Horrors in terms of tone and vibe. And I think that if they went back to the 80s for that Back to the Future musical that was supposed to be pretty good. So I think Gremlins is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love that. I'd watch the shit out of a Gremlins musical, and definitely watch that.
Yeah, the After Midnight show would be the best show.
Hey,
how do you determine what is After Midnight? Anyways, right. The one that I think would be a great stage musical. No, I'm just kidding. I went with the Hudsucker Proxy, genuinely think would be a ton of fun on stage. It's got that New York feel anyway. Like, there's just a lot of fun songs that could come from,
for
kids.
You have a song called, for kids.
That's what I'm saying. The hula hoop number alone is going to be so fun and impressive.
Yeah,
this is
awesome.
So, yes, it would be.
Hudsucker Proxy, the musical, copyright, Aaron Dicer. If it shows up, I am suing you.
Correct. You have the IP.
I do. I own it now.
I'm going to disappoint all of our chat by saying I want to see a stage play / musical of either The Square or Triangle of Sadness. Why not?
Let's go.
That's right. I think that would be awesome. I think these two movies lend themselves to stage very, very well. And I think making a whole bunch of people uncomfortable inside one of those stuffy Broadway theaters would be amazing.
Well, and so Triangle of Sadness is already split up into three acts, basically, it is. So that's a natural trimming place there. I think that could work. I'm not sure I would be on the front row, but I think that could work.
Yeah, you wouldn't be on the front row, and especially if, like, in The Square, they decided to make it interactive or something like that, Can you imagine? Can you imagine that? They make The Square interactive?
Well, he would come after me, because I'm clearly going to be the alpha male in the room.
Clearly.
He definitely would. Looking over at the chat, let's see. We have... Paulie says Glass Onion would be a great stage. I think basically anything Knives Out would be a great stage show. Yeah. Absolutely. Castor says I think a lot of Coen Brothers movies would work there. Yep. Reformed Florida Man, is there such thing? Says Fargo as a play. I think so. I think definitely. Castor says I choose Oh Brother Where Art Thou, since we're in the middle of the Coen Brothers here. Alan says Jurassic Park would be pretty good. Ooh. I agree with you. I think that would be an amazing stage show.
That could be awesome.
You could do something with that for sure. And then we have Nolan says Megalopolis stage play. Hopefully we can make it make sense or not. I don't know. I don't know what I want there. Lang says, The Revenant. Ooh, having a bear attack on stage. That would be insane. That would be insane. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you so much for coming out and watching us talk about movies today. I know that it wasn't a super popular choice, but hey, I'm with Aaron on this one. You guys can be with Jeremy. You guys can be with Jeremy all you want to. That's fine. That's the reason why we all have different tastes and whatnot. And no one should tell you that you're wrong except when Aaron says stuff. That's going to do it. Next week is In the Heat of the Night from 1967. We appreciate you guys coming out, and that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time.
See you guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia at cinemasins.com.
So in that little box in the right-hand corner, comments would just show up during the show.
So then what's going to happen when one viewer's like, fuck, fuck, fuckity, fuck, 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 fuckity, fuck, fuck, fuck?
I don't know. I'm guessing it will show up.
As often happens.
Yeah. How do you guys feel about copyright stuff overall? Like, is it too stringent now? Is it not stringent enough now? Like, I've never really had this conversation with you guys.
Like, case by case, right?
Like, yeah.
I think it's egregious. Like, for instance, this is an old one But like, and this is, we didn't get sued over it or anything like that, but I thought it was really goofy when on our Percy Jackson video, the label behind Lady Gaga decided to say, oh, you're playing our song and therefore we, you know, you can't play this video or whatever. And it was barely any poker face in the background playing. And it wasn't, you know, obviously no one's going to go to our video to listen to the song.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So like, to me, I feel like there's an issue of like, okay, I get it. You want to make it black and white. You don't want to have any unauthorized use. You don't want to have any gray area. So therefore every little use, but I think that there should be some leeway where you're just like, yeah, I mean, no one is, no one is like listening to Poker Face for free here, you know, because it just happens to be in the far background for 3 seconds in a video. So that's just a YouTube thing. That's not really copyright thing, but
it is, because it goes to the heart of what is the purpose, right? What are the purposes of these laws? And it seems to me the purpose of the laws were to keep people who create something from having that just stolen from them so that they can't make a living off of it, right? Mm-hmm. So is it harming Lady Gaga for that, you know, couple seconds to be in there? I think it'd be really hard to argue that it is.
And to me, it clearly isn't harming. And I don't think, you know, it's not, I don't think it has anything to do with her. I just think it's the label
or the writers or anybody that's getting money from, and, you know, plays.
We had the same sort of deal with when we did, I almost don't even want to mention the movie and the song, because these are very litigious people. But I'll just say there was another movie that has the title of a song in it that plays that song at the end of it. And it was barely any of it, and yet we were read the Riot Act over having that on our video.
I'll never forget when we did the Into the Spider-Verse, and like that Sins video has the first boom bass note of that Sunflower song, and that's it. That just has that boom, and it goes into the Sin, and we got a copyright notice on that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's wild.
I feel like that's the one thing that's missing. They don't have the infrastructure to decide, hey, was this used to enhance the production, or was this just incidental, or what? And they're just basically just going, nope, you can't play any part of that song and whatever. And so therefore we're going to go after you for it. So, I don't know in the real world where a lot of this is, what, like actual copyright law, where people are going after people for, like, you know, I don't know. I know that songs happen a lot where it's someone has done a song that is so close to an original or whatever that, you know, people go after it and whatever. I feel like most of the time, yeah, they probably are stealing those songs and trying to repurpose it as something new, and you know, but you have to go through that whole, like, is it really the same song? Is it, can you copyright notes in an order? You know, all these type of things, but
well,
I don't know.
This is, I've thought about this way too much, considering I have zero power to do anything about it. But the idea of owning art was always something that was controversial, right? In when these laws happened, it wasn't to say, the intent was not, oh, now you can own art. The intent was, now you can protect your earning ability for an amount of time before art does what art does, which become everybody's. Art just becomes everybody's. It's a very wonderful thing and a generative thing, right? So that's the idea of public domain, was, okay, after this certain amount of time, art's going to do what art does, and anybody can tell a Sherlock story. Anybody can tell, let's say, a Mickey Mouse story. Let's, you know, whatever, after a certain amount of time. And what the laws inadvertently did was create ownership of art, which is a totally different thing. And now these companies are like, well, why should it ever go into public domain? Why can't I fight it to own it forever? Because it's property. Well, it's never been intended that way. And Disney understands to play the system by buying other people's art, which takes it even further away from its intent, right? The intent was to protect George Lucas for, you know, to give him an ability to earn on Star Wars, not some company that bought the rights to the stuff he created. Like, it's just, there should be different public domain rules for corporations that buy IP than there are for individuals who create something.
I need to look into this more. It's just something that I was wondering about as I started watching Superman 4. Don't ask why I was watching Superman 4. There's a credit at the beginning of it that says Superman series initially created by Alexander Salkind. And like the first three movies all have the Salkinds, Alexander and his son Ilya, as producers on the movie. So what happened with the first three is they produced these movies and Warner Brothers distributed the movies. I always thought that Warner Brothers owned DC. They did. Even back in the 70s, they owned DC, so I don't know to what extent they didn't own Superman, because the Salkinds owned Superman, and they were bringing it to Warner Brothers. From what I understand, I don't know the whole story, so this should not be but that's not the point as to who owned what and whatever. I just think it's interesting that when they did the fourth movie, the Salkinds sold it to Canon Films. Canon Films was a studio in the 80s. It was cranking out all sorts of, like, you know, a lot of cheap product and stuff like that. They sold Superman to them. And now I'm sitting there going, but isn't Warner Brothers and I guess they weren't. I mean, Warner Brothers did come out with Superman 4, but they used Canon Films as the creator of the movie or whatever. So I'm like wondering how all that works too. Like, two guys own it and I guess they sell it to Warner Brothers, even though Warner Brothers has all this DC property. Maybe they had everything DC except Superman or something like that. It's a fascinating story to me.
Well, then you just, once you leave America and you start looking internationally, it gets even more fractured and weird.
Yes.
Like, there was a lawsuit to stop James Gunn's Superman from playing in certain countries because some random company has the rights for Superman in those countries or something.
Wow.
They worked it out. It's going to open in those countries. They probably just wanted a payday. But
yeah,
the idea that Warner's has already filmed a Superman movie, they're in post-production, and then out of the woodwork comes, you're not going to be able to show it in that country because I happen to have the rights to that, and you just didn't know it because that's how complicated copyright is. Every bit as important as the copyright discussion. I have just realized I forgot to shave my mustache this morning in the shower. And that's going to be a very weird, it's going to be strange for me until I get back there with the razor and fix it, but I'm showering with one hand these days because of my freaking lame thumb. And so I've got my left arm up in the air and I'm trying to like shave like this. So of course, I missed a bunch of spots.
I'm showering with one hand these days. The story of my adolescence by Aaron Dicer.
That's correct.